この ピストルは今あなたの心臓を狙っている。
Thank you. Bar so high, I've played some cool music because you haven't heard, crowd rock in a long time. When was the last time you heard Japanese jazz? Did you know there was Japanese jazz? You probably thought it was Japanese karaoke. No, there is Japanese jazz, and one of the hottest Japanese jazz groups is called Pistol Jazz, which is kind of what attracted me to it. You know, I come across a name like that, I said, come on, I gotta listen to these guys' music. Pistol Jazz. We'll be right back.
Yo, this is Festo D from High Roll Crew, and you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM online, freakradio.org, unlicensed, commercial, free.
Over the Flashpoints, and they got a big show for you, so stay tuned. We're out for now. Peace.
KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, 88.1, KFC up in Fresno.
Today on Flashpoints, we celebrate legendary linguist, political activist, author of over 100 books, Noam Chomsky, with a brand new speech delivered in Berkeley, California last night in honor and support of the Middle East Children's Alliance and the amazing founder, Barbara Lubin. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have a treat for you. Noam Chomsky was in town, 89 years old, over 100 books. Here, let me just read a few of these books. Deterring Democracy, For Reasons of State, Turning the Tide, U.S. Intervention in Central America and the Struggle for Peace, American Power and the New Mandarins, The Washington Connection and Third World Fascism, After the Catechism, Power, Postwar Indochina, On Power and Ideology Toward a New Cold War. I mean, this goes on and on. This is my hero. If you come into my office, I admit it, you're going to see a poster of a film made about the life and times of Noam Chomsky the size of my wall. What an extraordinary human being. Again, he was in town to celebrate the great work of the Middle East Children's Alliance, and KPFA was a co-sponsor, and we are delighted now to present you excerpts of Noam Chomsky, introduced by the amazing Barbara Lubin.
30 years ago, when I came back from Palestine, I decided with Howard, we had lunch together, and we decided we wanted to do something about what I had seen. I was shocked. I really couldn't believe a lot of the things I saw. I went to this forest where my family, my grandparents, had planted trees in memory of people in our family who were no longer alive. And on one hand, I watched and saw these trees. And then on the other hand, I was in a village the next day when the Israelis came and uprooted about 100 fruit trees in this village. And so on one hand, we plant them. On the other hand, we take them and kill them. It was everything that I saw on that trip was completely different than what I had learned from my family, from my Hebrew school, which I was thrown out of. But we decided that we would start an organization to work to make things better for children in Palestine. And we got a tiny office up on Chaddock, and Howard had this old computer from when he worked at the Daily Cal. And I brought my sofa in, so I would sort of lay on the sofa and decide what we should do. And Howard would do it. But we decided we'd have an advisory board, and the very first person that we called was Noam Chomsky. And I was so anxious about calling him. I mean, Noam Chomsky. And I talked to him a little bit about my trip and what I saw and what I wanted to do, and asked him if he would join our advisory board. And he immediately said, of course. And he did. He was the first person to join. I'm very grateful that Noam did that. I'm going to stop in a minute, but I did want to just share this with you. It's on the back of one of his books, and it says that Chomsky ranks with Marx, Shakespeare, and the Bible as one of the 10 most quoted sources in the humanities. More than the Bible. Please welcome Noam Chomsky.
This is to keep me honest, more or less. There's a great deal to say about the current situation in Israel-Palestine, the troubled region generally. The news ranges from good to truly ominous, and in between it ranges from awful to hideous. Let me start with some good news. The good news is that Mecca is alive and well. It's continuing the marvelous work that it's been doing for 30 years under Barbara's remarkable leadership. And there's real prospects for progress. They're often obscured by prevailing and understandable gloom. I'll return to that at the end. But let's begin with what's truly ominous. There is a growing likelihood of a regional war, a major war, which could be devastating. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned a few days ago, I'm quoting him, that an all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah might break out at any minute, engulfing the Middle East, even though he thinks neither party wants to fight. Sometimes a spark is enough to unleash this kind of conflict, and there are, unfortunately, plenty of sparks. Joost Hilterman of the International Crisis Group, who's very well informed, has been issuing similar warnings. These assessments were sharply criticized by Nicholas Noe, a very experienced and highly credible analyst. He argues that these assessments are far too optimistic. He estimates that Israel has already carried out thousands of military missions in Syria, and there's little reason, everyone agrees, that to expect that Israel will acquiesce in having foreign forces, Iranian, Russian, remaining in Syria, certainly anywhere near the Golan Heights, the Syrian territory that's illegally annexed by Israel. Iran and Hezbollah are constructing precision missile facilities, military infrastructure in Syria, Noe points out, perhaps beginning in Lebanon as well. That's a deterrent that Israel will not accept. Noe argues further, and this is his criticism of the others, that elements on both sides may actually want war. And there are, unfortunately, statements and even active measures that lend some credibility to this judgment. If there is a war, it would be an utter catastrophe. Israel's already announced its plans. A massive invasion by ground and air of Lebanon in an effort to destroy Hezbollah's retaliatory capacity. That's an outcome that's very unlikely, as Israeli military strategists must understand. In response to an invasion, there would almost certainly be a major missile attack on Israel, which would instantly invoke what Israel calls its Dahiya doctrine. A doctrine is named after an area of South Beirut that was devastated by the Israeli army, the IDF, in retaliation for resistance to Israel's 2006 invasion of Lebanon. The doctrine calls for overwhelming force against civilian targets in response to any resistance. It's already been invoked several times in Gaza in 2009 and Israel's assault, Operation Cast Lead, and again, even more destructively in the horrendous assault of 2014, Operation Protective Edge, which left several thousand Palestinians dead, including 500 children. Israel and Hezbollah have publicly locked themselves into what Israeli officials call the kindergarten scenario. What they mean is that an Israeli attack on precision missile factories in Syria or Lebanon will lead to counterstrikes against Israeli military bases and factories. And then the process begins to escalate in a familiar fashion to the point where kindergartens or anything else will be obliterated. Lebanon would likely be virtually destroyed, much of the remnants of Syria as well. Also Gaza, according to Israeli military authorities, fairly serious damage in Israel as well. Could even extend beyond, all the way to global war, which would in effect be terminal. That's not unlikely in the near future. Things are building up to that. But even if these immediate threats can be contained, there's more that's lurking not far behind. Israel has always made it very clear that it will accept no challenge to what it calls its qualitative military edge, QME. And that's now being threatened. So the most serious threat is nuclear. Israel, there's an Israeli strategic analyst, Chuck Freilich, recently pointed out in Haaretz that the countries of the region are developing nuclear energy. And with current technology, nuclear energy can easily morph to nuclear weapons. That would decisively undermine Israel's QME. It's what Israel calls a nightmare that it cannot tolerate. That does raise an immediate question, which extends well beyond this immediate case, which is severe enough. And the question is there a way to eliminate nuclear weapons in the Middle East? Actually, there's a very simple answer to that question. Establish a nuclear weapons-free zone with verifiability, which is easily possible. That would not only end this ominous threat, but it would also end any threat that Iran is alleged, I stress alleged, to pose with its nuclear policies. So the question is there any barrier to this? Well, Iran is certainly not a barrier. They've been vigorously advocating this for some time. What about the Arab states? They're the ones who actually initiated the proposal, Egypt, 20 years ago, and they, too, were strongly calling for it regularly. In fact, the rest of the world also agrees, almost. There's an exception, familiar exception, one barrier, the United States. Most recently, Obama and Clinton in 2015. Every 5 years, there's a review session of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The latest was 2015, and Obama, Clinton spoke for Obama, rejected this proposal and was quite explicit about the reasons. The reasons are no proposal can be accepted that calls for Israel's nuclear program to be placed under the auspices of the International Atomic Energy Agency, or that calls on Washington, or in fact anyone, to release information about Israeli nuclear facilities and activities, including information pertaining to previous nuclear transfers to Israel. That kills it. So no nuclear weapons-free zone, and we therefore march on to possible terminal war. The United States happens to be opposed to the entire world on this issue. Even the usually quite compliant Yukio Amano, who's head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, usually follows U.S. Demands pretty closely. But in this case, he did ask the foreign ministers of the 151 member states of the NPT to share views on how to implement a resolution, I'm quoting him again, demanding that Israel accede to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and throw its nuclear facilities open to IAEA oversight. Again, the usual barrier. Actually, the United States and, in fact, the United Kingdom happen to have a special responsibility to work to establish a Middle East nuclear weapons-free zone. The reason is this. When they were planning to invade Iraq, they had to concoct some kind of thin legal cover, and they appealed to a Security Council resolution, Resolution 687, which called on Iraq to terminate its development of weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. and U.K., as you recall, U.K. claimed that they had not done so, claims that were soon proven false. But what's relevant here is that the resolution commits its signers to move to establish a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. So there's a special obligation of the United States, which happens to be the one holdout to doing this. All of this has been perfectly clear for years. It's unmentionable in the United States mainstream. So we continue the march to nuclear war. Notice that that includes Iran, not just the Israeli concern about their QME and what that might lead to. Well, that's the ominous news, and it is very ominous. And like a lot of other ominous news, there's an answer, a possible answer, and the answer lies right here, our responsibility. So let's move on from the truly ominous to the merely hideous. Have a smile. It's Gaza. For years, UNRWA, which keeps the Gaza Strip barely alive, has been warning that by 2020, the Strip will be literally unlivable. The conclusion is reiterated in a major UN study just issued July 2017, reviews the shocking details from 2006. The report is called Gaza 10 Years Later, 2006 to 2017. So let's take a look at what happened in the preceding 10 years that has led to this situation. By the year 2005, the Israeli government had come to understand that it was pointless to devote a very large part of the IDF to protecting a few thousand settlers in the Gaza Strip, who were illegal settlers, of course, who were taking over much of the land and resources and exhausting the limited aquifer. So they decided to withdraw the settlers, which is very easy to do. All you have to do is withdraw the army, send lorries for the settlers to climb into. They can leave their subsidized illegal homes in the Gaza Strip and be transported to illegal subsidized homes elsewhere in the occupied territories. Very straightforward. And in fact, a similar scenario is quite possible today for the illegal settlers in the other parts of the occupied territories. But instead of doing it the easy way, the Israeli authorities decided to stage national trauma with heartbreaking pictures. Many of you will remember them. Heartbreaking pictures of children being forced out of their homes and cries of never again, which means don't interfere with our takeover of the rest of Palestine. Actually, that was a rerun of a national trauma that was staged in 1982 when Israel withdrew from the Egyptian Sinai. In both cases, this has been ridiculed by Israeli commentators, among them the late Baruch Kimmerling, Israel's leading sociologist, even the press. But it played very well for the intended international audience, as some of you will recall. A further motive for the disengagement was explained with engaging cynicism by the official who was in charge of negotiating and implementing the withdrawal, Dov Weisglass. He explained, on quoting him, that the disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so that there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. And he went on, what I effectively agreed to with the Americans was that the major settlement blocks in the West Bank would not be dealt with at all, and the rest will not be dealt with until the Palestinians turn into Finns, actually Finns of a very special kind who don't mind if Finland is taken over by foreign occupiers. And he went on to explain, Weisglass, that the significance of the withdrawal is the freezing of the political process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. And you prevent the discussion about the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. Effectively, this whole package that is called the Palestinian state, with all that it entails, has been removed from our agenda indefinitely. And all of this with the President and President Bush, the President's authority and permission, and the ratification of both houses of Congress, which is fair enough. It's called American exceptionalism. It's again the United States versus the world. What about the Gazans? Well, Weisglass didn't leave them out. He went on to say that they will remain on a diet, but not to make them die of hunger. That wouldn't look good. And with their vaunted technical efficiency, Israeli experts calculated precisely how many calories a day Gazans need for survival. Stance not unfamiliar here right now for the undeserving poor, but it's another topic. Well, the disengagement in 2005 was depicted as a noble effort to pursue peace. It still is presented that way, but the reality is quite different. Israel never relinquished control of Gaza. It's accordingly recognized as the occupying power by the United Nations, the United States, other states, in fact every state apart from Israel itself. Now, there is a comprehensive scholarly study of settlement in the occupied territories by two leading Israeli scholars, Idit Zertal and Akiva Eldar, and they describe what actually happened when Israel withdrew. As they write, the ruined territory was not released for even a single day from Israel's military grip or from the price of the occupation that the inhabitants pay every day. After the disengagement, Israel left behind scorched earth, devastated services, people with nearly neither a present nor a future. The settlements were destroyed in an ungenerous move by an unenlightened occupier, which in fact continues to control the territory and kill and harass its inhabitants by means of its formal military might. The major slaughters, periodic slaughters, have a special term in Israel. They're called mowing the lawn, more accurately, shooting fish in a pond. Well, that was the withdrawal in November 2005. Israel and the Palestinian Authority established a truce. The wording of the truce is important. It's been repeated over and over. The truce called for an opening of a crossing between Gaza and Egypt, and continuous operation of crossings between Israel and Gaza for the import-export of goods and the transit of people, the reduction of obstacles to movement within the West Bank, bus and truck convoys between the West Bank and Gaza, the building of a seaport in Gaza, and the reopening of the airport in Gaza that Israeli bombing had demolished. That's been the model for later truce agreements, repeated often, almost verbatim. And it's also the model for what immediately followed, set the pattern for what has happened in the past 10 years. A couple of weeks after the truce was established, the Palestinians committed a really major crime. They held the first free election in the Arab world. It was recognized as free and fair, but they elected the wrong people, Hamas. Israel immediately reacted by imposing harsh sanctions, stepped up attacks on Gaza. The truce agreement, of course, was gone. The United States went further. It at once initiated plans for a military coup to overthrow the government. That's a standard U.S. procedure when an election has the wrong outcome. There's a name for that, too. It's called democracy promotion in U.S. political discourse. Then Hamas committed an even worse crime. It preempted the coup, and in the fighting that followed, it took over governance of the Gaza Strip. And then Israel mowed the lawn with U.S. support. Well, that's the pattern that's prevailed since for the past 10 years, leading to the situation that UNRWA, the UN study, report. A truce is established pretty much along the lines of the November 2005 agreement. Hamas observes the truce. Israel never observes it, continuously violates it. Finally, it escalates the violation, the violence, which does elicit a Hamas response, and that serves as a pretext for the next episode of mowing the lawn. That's the record for the past 10 years. I won't run through the details. There's no time. There are ample materials in print about this. I've reviewed the record in detail myself. There are quite remarkable eyewitness reports of particular episodes of mowing the lawn, sometimes by victims. One of the most memorable is by journalist Mohammed Omer, others by Mats Gilbert. He's the heroic Norwegian trauma surgeon who works in the main Gaza hospital during the slaughters, by fine American journalist Max Blumenthal, by others. The whole sordid record is from the, even starting back years earlier, is reported in extensive detail in a very important book, Norman Finkelstein's recent outstanding study of Gaza, which is aptly subtitled Inquest into Martyrdom. And the pattern is likely to be repeated very soon. It's building up right now. Meanwhile, with continued U.S. backing, decisive U.S. backing, always under the Israeli lash, Gaza descends to literal unlivability very soon. Now it's accelerated by the Trump decision to cut more than half of the meager U.S. aid to UNRWA, the thin lifeline for the Palestinians. One member of the Washington diplomatic contingent advocated a full and immediate cut. That's UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. She's one of the uglier and more disgraceful figures of the administration, and the competition is pretty keen. She's probably angling for Secretary of State, maybe more, so watch out. But in this case, the so-called adults in the room, like Mad Dog Mattis, thought that Haley's brutal proposal would reduce the diet too sharply for now, so it's only half of the limited supply of aid that's being cut. Well, meanwhile, a gratuitous violence continues without a break. The most recent example I know of is yesterday. A farmer in the Gaza Strip who was working in a apparently completely peaceful area, a couple hundred meters from Israel's borders, was murdered, shot by Israeli soldiers in his fields. A couple of days earlier, a Palestinian fisherman was killed by the Israeli Navy. They attacked his boat, wounded others. They claimed that he had strayed beyond the very narrow limit that Israel imposes in order to ensure that Palestinian fishermen will stay quite close to shore, that is, within the waters that are heavily polluted because Israel destroyed the sewage facilities. That's a tiny glimpse of the horrifying news. It's particularly grotesque because Gaza could be a kind of Mediterranean paradise. It's got a wonderful climate. It's got beautiful beaches, rich fishing grounds, fine fruit and vegetables, highly educated workforce, mostly young, and people who are amazingly resilient, despite the exquisite torture, as any visitor sees very quickly. It even has rich natural gas fields offshore, which were stolen by Israel, in this case with the apparent connivance of the Palestinian Authority. Words really fail to describe what's happening there. Actually, I was able to visit myself a couple of years ago in between two episodes of mowing the lawn. I hope to return this time with my wife Valeria, who, like Mecca, has a special interest in the fate of children who are subjected to onerous, often traumatic conditions. She happens to be from Brazil, where there are plenty of examples. There are plenty of examples right here. But the situation of Palestinian children in Gaza and the Lebanese refugee camps is particularly poignant. They are really imprisoned with no hope for escape right now, except in our hands. I'll come back to that. Well, that's the horrible, horrific news. So let's turn now to the merely awful news. The remainder of the occupied territories. That's the West Bank and the Syrian Golan Heights. There, most of the Druze population fled or was expelled when Israel conquered the Heights in 1967, later annexing it in violation of a UN Security Council resolution, for once with the United States joining the world, but it didn't matter. Well, in the West Bank, one of the analogs to mowing the lawn is the regular murder of young Palestinians by Israeli snipers, who are evidently trained to shoot teenagers in the head or the upper body when they're seen throwing rocks.
You know, this isn't about getting... It's an amazing speech that you can get, or you can get the
Times, New York Times! New York Times, mass destruction, Judith Miller! New York Times! New York Times! Misled us into that war. They always do.
You think they're going to report honestly about Israel now with Netanyahu in Washington, D.C., hugging along with Donald Trump, ready to finalize the embassy in Jerusalem, to finish the ethnic cleansing of Palestine? We brought you Noam Chomsky tonight. We brought you a person who is one of the most censored intellectuals of our time in this country. We brought you Noam Chomsky tonight. And we bring you something special every night. Thank you. Thank you. and we are hoping that you will bring us something special. Do you know how much we have raised? We have raised $300 because we brought you Noam Chomsky. This isn't about getting... It's an amazing speech that you can get, or you can get the whole package with the Robert Perry books, the 10-hour retrospective, and Noam Chomsky for $350. But it's not that. You can get that for $350. But it's not that. It's that this radio station and this program, which has been recognized by the National Whistleblowers Conference as a whistleblowing radio station, this non... corporate, no holds barred, fight back network is really, really an endangered species. It is. That canary in the coal mine is an endangered species. And I can't believe I can't get these phones to pop for Noam Chomsky or the Robert Perry stuff or anything you've heard, or a pair of socks or whatever. But again, it's not that premium. It's that commitment to free speech. It's that love of the First Amendment. It's that willingness to learn, to grow, and to be a part of an institution that is a university, a radical university in the airwaves. That is what we are, and that is what I am asking you to support right now, and I am hoping you are going to call right now. 1-800-439-5732. I honestly, really, seriously, $300. This is the worst pitching day of my life. On Noam Chomsky? On the most censored partner that Pacifica Radio has had? We have! Pacifica, I remember I did my, when I started breaking Iran-Contra in New York City on WBAI in New York, that was the first time I met Noam Chomsky, and he came to New York and had a benefit for us. That was on WBAI, our sister station. And I remember, for the first time, I didn't even hardly know who Noam Chomsky was, but I sat there, he did a benefit for us, and I heard him speak, and I said, oh my God. How come I never heard his name in high school and college? How come I never heard Noam Chomsky? Yes, he was an internationally renowned, globally known, revolutionary linguist, but he was also a radical activist. I never heard of him. He's still censored. He is still the most censored man, one of the most censored men. He's probably more censored than Daniel Ellsberg, and that's saying a lot. 1-800-439-5732. Can we pick this up, folks? Can we get things jumping a little bit? Can we make sure that we raise some of the money we need? Because I'm going to go out of here, like, embarrassed on this one. Seriously. It's, oh my God, it's like $550. It's $550. And it's like the dead of night. Nobody's interested in free speech radio? Oh, I know you are. And I am really appealing now to the perhaps 80, 85% of you listening who have never stood up. I'm asking you to stand up now. Or if you've let your subscription lapse, I'm asking you to step forward now and hit the numbers. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're going to need some real help now at 5:51 in the afternoon. I'd love you to get a copy of this Noam Chomsky speech, Wither Palestine. He was speaking last night in Berkeley for the Middle East Children's Alliance, with a beautiful introduction by Barbara Lubin. You can get a copy, a CD for $75. You can get it as a DVD for $100. If you want to get it with the entire Robert Perry package of books and 10-hour retrospective, you can get all that for $350. But I'm going to need you to stand up now And if you've got a little extra now, this would be one of the, so some of you folks who are incredibly generous have a little extra and have given us 500, 1,000, a couple of thousand in the past. This would be a very good day for that, because it is slow, oh so slow. It's a Monday and we're dying here at 5:52 in the afternoon. I hate to admit that. I love the work. I love the fact that we've got this brand new speech, this powerful speech given by Noam Chomsky last night in Berkeley. I love the fact that we can thank you with it. But I need you to call so I can say thank you. And you can say thank you. And we can together fight for this scrappy network that deserves to have a voice in this community and in this world. We are, this network is more necessary than ever. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and I am looking for a phone to ring. I am listening to hear a bell of freedom. I am hoping something is wrong here and that, you know, maybe the switchboard is down or something. Maybe the phones aren't working. Oh, God. 1-800-439-5732. Maybe I need to go and shout out the window. Let's stand up together for free speech radio. Let's have a real speak out for the station. Let's stand up, because we believe that it's important to stand against censorship. Do any of you doubt me when I say Noam Chomsky is about among the most censored people on American networks of any person you can think of? Seriously. You know, any intellectual notable of his stature. Noam Chomsky, anywhere else in the world, network television. United States, not so much. 1-800-439-5732. And I get, is this it? We're still stuck. We've raised $300 towards this $1,200 match. $300 towards this $1,200 match. I can't believe it. You could do it on the web. Have we checked the web? Maybe there's $1 million somebody called in on the web at kpfa.org. You can do that. You can go on the web, kpfa.org, hit the pledge button, subscribe there. You can do it. But please do it. 1-800-439-5732. Please do it. Now, we are in big trouble on this hour. It is 5:55. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA.org, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Come on, folks. How about a last-minute raw for free speech radio? Stand up. Put your hands up. Step forward. Put your money where your beliefs are. Let's get this moving. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We are hoping to move this along. We are trying to move this along. We're going to need some big support to do it. 1-800-439-5732. Anything on the web, Mike? Okay, so we got a few hundred bucks on the web, so that's good. 1-800-439-5732. 4 minutes to go, and I'm starting to, they say, don't take this personally, Dennis. It's just a slow day. But every day is an important day. We had a great day on Friday, but we have to have a great day today. And you could still change it now. We could have a miraculous, you know, grassroots operation at the roots, and you could change it. And please do. It's up to you. 1-800-439-5732. 3-2. We could use an uprising at the roots. 1-800-439-5732. Ernie Goldstein and Claire, thank you. Maya Alishi, thank you so much for your generous contribution. We have a $1,200 match. I think we've made about half of it now. Half of it? 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're going to need to really pick this thing up. And I hope you will help us do it. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And let's see. Mike, could you just pick it up for a minute or so? Oh, 1-800-439-5732. Let's see. We're at 5:57 and a half. 2 minutes to go. We've got 500. So this is where we are now.
It's an addition.
We got another 500.
Yes.
Beautiful. All right. Well, I think we're over 1,000. 1-800-439-5732. I've got 90 seconds here. It may very well. I don't know. You know what? It's going to be a close race for the worst day that I've ever had in terms of asking you, failing to say the right thing to get you all to stand up, to step forward. I thought I wouldn't even have to breathe. I'd say, new speech, Noam's. Chomsky last night, $100 contribution, 1-800-439-5732, and the phones would ring off the hooks. That's what I thought. I guess I was sort of foolish there. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA.org. We are down to the last minute. We are down to the last minute, and it would be spectacular. In a minute, you can do it. You can do it. KPFA.org. Hit the pledge button. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. You can do it now. We'll take it. We need it. We can use it. We're hoping you're going to call. Come on. Jay Sheeks, thank you so much. Walter Carruthers, thank you so much for calling, for helping. And we are delighted. Thank you, Gloria Goldsmith, for your last-minute contribution. I'm Dennis Bernstein. I am hoping that you will still keep dialing 1-800-439-5732. And Mike Biggs, it is yours.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Tune in to Democracy Now!, Monday through Friday, 12 noon.
On Free Radio Santa Cruz, also known as Freak Radio, community-based FM radio station, which people certainly here know, operating without an FCC license since 1995.
Democracy Now!, 12 noon, Monday through Friday, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM or freakradio.org. Also check out democracynow.org.
International Women's Day, this is Democracy Now!
We are protesting for equality, for the rights of women, to show we are not inferior. We want to work, live in peace, to have the same rights as any man, because we are people. And as people, we have the same right to protest, to go on strike.
Women in Spain launch a one-day feminist strike as protests and rallies are held around the world, calling for gender equality, the end of sexual violence, and better working conditions. It's the first International Women's Day since the Me Too movement galvanized women around the world. We'll go to Madrid. Then we'll speak with award-winning playwright Eve Ensler about the 20th anniversary of V-Day to end violence against women and girls, as well as her play In the Body of the World.
The sun's just beginning to come out. The women are there, and they are strong. I have made a promise.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is International Women's Day, and across Spain, women are on strike. Here we are, the feminists, they're chanting, banging pots and pans and refusing to work for 24 hours. Organizers say it's the first nationwide women's strike in Spain's history. Their motto, if we stop, the world stops. This is Concha Gonzalez, a psychoanalyst who's not practicing today because she's on strike.
It scares society and also many women when they realize how strong we can be, especially when we are together. That's why I will strike, and that is why I am here.
The historic women's strike in Spain comes as women across the world, from Afghanistan to Philippines to Mexico, are marking International Women's Day, demanding equality and justice and an end to patriarchy and violence against women. We'll have more on their strikes, marches, and protests after headlines. In the United States, the confrontation between the Trump administration and California escalated Wednesday as Attorney General Jeff Sessions traveled to Sacramento and attacked California for its so-called sanctuary laws, a day after the administration sued California over its policies limiting local law enforcement cooperation with federal immigration agencies.